Accession number 10167, Reel 8.
Mr. Ronald Elliott, Reel 8. If you could take up the story now with the Garigliano crossing and the start of the casino campaign round about January 44.
Yes. What we weren't doing, really, was first of all moving up towards the Garigliano and subsequently onto a line, a part of which would be casino. It was a winter line. I'm not offhand, I can't recall which line it is, but that is it. Now, it all started with the objective was for us in the beginning to cross the Garigliano, which I think the Hampshires did themselves, and we subsequently followed on after them. It was not, as far as we were concerned, not an opposed crossing, so there was nothing that there was any problem in, but we did find that the bridgehead was quite shallow. There were some tremendously high mountains immediately close to the Garigliano, and they were a very great defense, and in fact remained so for the greater part of the casino battle subsequently. Now, most of the time that we spent in this area, and we had, this was coming up to the end of a period of continuous fighting for us, generally speaking. But we were in a very depleted state. We only had, I think, about two or three companies. Our company, I recall, spent about 6 weeks, which was a longish time, more or less in the front line, in an area across the Garigliano, beneath a big mountain. We had a particular company position dug in under the lee of a bit of a hill just prior to the mountain. We had sangers. We were into sangers then. The area was so stony that one couldn't dig down. So you got stones and built up, and you built up fortifications which gave you protection against shell fire, which was pretty regular. We were shelled almost entirely all the time throughout the day and sporadically at night. Various other battalions tried to take these positions. Montefiore, I think, was one of them, and a guards battalion tried to take them. They came through, as I remember, on one occasion. One has a high regard for some formations. Guards were one. Everybody thought a lot of the guards, really. And we thought a lot of the Gurkhas subsequently, but the guards. And this occasion, I remember, the guards were led by an officer on a horse into battle. Quite incredible. Talk about quality of leadership. They didn't succeed, not even the guards. And as I say, this remained a hard nut to crack, I think, until in fact it was done by was it the French? The French did it finally in the last battle of Casino. I forget. Anyway, as far as we were concerned, it rained, it was miserable. We had lice, I recall, at that time. We spent a good part of our time killing lice on our shirts. They had a powder which they supplied to us for killing lice, which you had to rub into the seams of your shirt and your trousers. You put it in your trousers and it got onto your balls and it inflamed your balls. Absolutely incredible. I had a boil also at the time. You can imagine the depths of unhappiness that there was at that moment.
So morale was pretty low.
Morale was pretty low, yes. We'd come, I think, There's a sort of a natural period in this. One comes to the end of one's tether, no matter how good one is. As I say, it's a question of attrition. You've lost a lot of your people. There comes a time when going forward is slower and slower and you're not doing as well. And people back probably become aware of that because we were pulled out shortly afterwards.
Would people actually malinger or in any way become less efficient because of that? I mean, would people duck out of things or avoid dangerous situations?
We were conscious of that later on. This comes out, I think, later on in the month.
Okay, well...
But round about this time, we did have a part in history, only a very small part, a footnote. Just for one short period of time, we were taken out, was Don Company, and used as a reserve for what was to be the first American attack on Cassino. They were crossing the Rapido, which was a tributary of the Garigliano, which subsequently was a major problem for them. But it was the first one, the first attempt they made. And I think it was the 36th American Division. We thought it was a green division, and we didn't feel that. Probably they did it particularly professionally, but we all accepted it was a hellish battle that they were being asked to undertake. Crossing a river, it was flooded on both sides, and the Germans had all of their casino emplacements, all of their fortifications just waiting for them, and they were actually mowed down. But it was intended, so we were told, that if they moved on and crossed the Rapido, we were to take over the positions that they'd left, and we would be the base from which the whole of the casino operation was subsequently to develop. But somewhat surprisingly, it didn't. So that was just a foothold in it. And I remember the story went that the commander of this division said to our company, "Gee, you fellas must be an iron division to have done what you did." And that made us all feel very happy and think, he doesn't know what this iron division is like. It's hellishly rusty at the moment. And what I think is that clearly the fact that formations naturally have a finite end to their immediate usefulness must be sometimes available to the establishment, because towards the end of February, or the middle of February, we were pulled out for a rest. And before very long, it became quite clear that something important was happening, because more and more people turned up from base headquarters. Our kit bags arrived, and then we suddenly realized that we were being pulled out, and we did, in fact, finish up going to the Middle East. So someone had got the message that, although, and I think this is probably the period of time when the 16th DLI was at its most effective, in a sense, we had come to our immediate end as a useful and effective unit at that point in time. And
so you feel that they took you out, they timed it just right?
Just about right, yes. I don't think we'd have done, we wouldn't have been able to do much more. We just about had. I mean, we had come through not only some very tough battles, but we were finishing up in quite the worst spell of Italian weather and the worst conditions that one could ever have foreseen. So it really was a combination of both, I think, both the fighting and the conditions. So we embarked for the Middle East on HMS Sobieski, I recall. And we first went to a transit camp in Egypt, near Port Said, I think it was. And we had a trip to Cairo. That was the beginning of a bit of enjoyment. We all went to Cairo, and of course it was totally different. Life was being on holiday, really. Not without its problems, because the Arabs fiddled everybody and stole money, and people were beaten up and all that sort of thing. So it was not without its difficulties there. But
they were beaten up by gangs of Arabs. Or
One of the things that did happen was that there were the shoeshine boys that were always around, and they would just sort of put a blob of boot polish on your boots as you were walking past, show you, and then lure you down an alleyway to have your shoes polished, and then perhaps if there was no one around, you could even be attacked at times. But certainly you would be made to pay quite heavily for the privilege. And quite a lot of this went on. But there was some tour while we were there. I think it was the 78th Division who were also pulled out round about the time, had this problem, and they beat up one bar in Cairo for overcharging. And there was quite a bit of a hoo-ha about it, but no more than the Arabs deserved, I think. Because, you know, they were taking advantage somewhat.
Were you warned at all to not get to go out in pairs? Or?
Oh, yes, and there was sort of VD and that sort of thing. You also had that. But, you know, that apart, had a glorious time. We went to see the pyramids and stayed in a hotel and enjoyed ourselves, and it was quite lovely. The whole of the period in the Middle East really was primarily a training sort of time. We spent some time in Egypt in a camp. We went to Palestine, and we were there in Jerusalem at times when they were having problems with one of the gangs, the Stern Gang or whatever, something like that. So we did have at times some sort of policing duties in Jerusalem. But we primarily went to a camp near Nathania, and we stayed there, and we did training exercises.
What sort of exercises were you doing? Were they new techniques, or was it just...
It was advanced stuff. It was mostly tactical exercises, going out, you know, with companies and battalions, and mock warfare, this sort of thing. And also, Bull came back into it again, as we'd be bound to do.
Was it more advanced than the stuff you'd been doing? Because you were an experienced battalion. What were they trying to teach you that you didn't already know?
I don't know. I don't think that was anything new at that point in time that I recall. Of course, the other thing was that we were also brought up to strength, so it was a question of bringing everyone up to the same level. And making us fit and healthy again was part of it. We were there in Palestine, and we also went up into Syria and had some training in there as well.
In Palestine, what were these guard duties? What did they involve? Or would you not be part of that as signallers?
I think it was just a question of it. The odd time or two, we had to go in and occupy some buildings. But it was no more than just casual things. It didn't last very long. But
you didn't actually get involved in any of the...
There was the odd bit of firing and shooting going on. But I think it was just a temporary thing. It sort of flared up and died down again. We didn't do very much, and we weren't there very long at all.
When you went into Syria, that was just for more training?
Yes. Of a more advanced nature. We went into the desert and did some really... quite sophisticated battle exercises. And then gradually worked our way back again. And in all of this, of course, we had time to visit, you know, places in the Middle East. I mean, we, as tourists, saw all the places in Palestine and Beirut and Damascus. So it was really... from a personal point of view, it was a great experience.
Did you feel that the morale recovered of the battalion? Did you get your store of courage, or
Well, you wouldn't know that whilst you're playing around with it. I mean, playing it sort of is rather different. And everyone was quite relaxed, you see.
But did morale recover, I mean?
Well, so far as one was aware. This is the point. I mean, you wouldn't know that until you went into action again, you see. I suspect that it did, superficially, as far as anyone could tell. And we certainly looked as though we were quite proficient when it came to all the exercises and so forth that we did.
Were you developing a unit loyalty to the 16th now?
I mean, oh, yes. I mean, I wouldn't have left there anyway. I liked what I was doing, apart from the element of action, but I obviously couldn't change that at all. I perhaps have liked not being in company terminals, but obviously I was an experienced company terminal now, and there wasn't much chance of my not being used that way. But we were together as a signal unit, so in all of this, we were back to the big happy family again, and although some members of it were regarded as being somewhat under the arm because they were teachers' pets and didn't get involved in the dirty work, the rest of us were all of a like mind, and we were very pleased to be working together. So it was in July the 1st that we returned from the Middle East back into Italy again. We arrived, I think it was the Sobieski again that took us back, and we went back into the south.
Were you apprehensive about this?
Yes, yes. I don't think anybody was very happy about going back into action again. I mean, there's all the difference in the world between playing at and being on holiday, but this, you know, was coming back. And this is symptomatic, I think, of any time, even when one is in action. You're generally on a sort of a stand-to situation where you know that you're going to go, say, into action tomorrow. So you've got between now and tomorrow, really, to make the most of it. This is the point. You take advantage and live that moment in time until it happens. And sometimes you're down to you within 2 hours' notice of going in, so you don't do anything, but you just sort of savour the fact that you're not going into action. So, although we'd all realised it was all going to come to an end, when it did come, of course, nobody was at all looking forward to it. We finished up really in the sort of the Umbrian region of Italy. Whilst we've been away, Rome had fallen, I think, in the line that swung right back up north again to, I think it was the Gothic line at this point in time, and we'd been clearly brought back to break into the Gothic line. Round about Bastardo, which was not far away from Orvieto, in that sort of region, we did, I remember, a lot of river crossings, which I thought in the event, and now subsequently, was a bit belated because we didn't do any sort of river crossing to speak of.
This is training.
Training a river crossing, yes, by all sorts of sophisticated means, and they had better equipment in those days, but subsequently we never had a river to cross with quite the same calibre, so it was all somewhat unnecessary, but it was all bringing us to a different level. So, yes, I think in Italy we were onto a more sophisticated level of training for particular purposes. And by about the end of the month, we went back into action. But before that again, from where we were in this sort of transit area, we had this little experience where we were taken down to Perugia, which was quite some distance south from where we were, to Manor Root, because the king was paying a visit. And we travelled nearly all day in these vehicles. Red hot it was. Lined this road in the midday sun. They came along with water carriers, I remember, sprinkling it on the road to keep the dust down. And the rest of us had been damn glad of having something to drink. the king came along, it was old George. He was dead white. I remember he had these very white milky knees with a blanket over them, and it was red hot. And the officers were saying, "Hip, hip, hooray!" And everybody was saying, "Hooray!" And the lack of enthusiasm must have been quite noticeable even to the king, because we were right up to our noses in it by then. I don't think anybody cared very much, but the thought of having to go through all of that just to go and say hello to the king, nobody was at all charmed. So that was our that was supposed to be, I suppose, a morale booster he'd come along to say to us, but in fact he didn't. He just went by on a jeep like that, and we were supposed to have given him three cheers, which we didn't.
Were you still with D Company or Don Company?
They sent me back to Don Company, actually. I had Bill Cram still, but I had another lad called Jackie Wells with me. George Taylor, as I remember, went somewhere else. I don't know why they broke it up, but they did. Jack Wells, story I'll tell later, I think, rather refused this, but I really didn't feel that I could wholly trust him. I mean, part of this being in a terminal meant that you had absolute faith in the people that you worked with, that you could trust them in the last resort to do what had to be done. I didn't feel entirely happy about Jackie Wells. Bill Cram, of course, was wholly revival, at least to me. But that was the team I was given, so I went to D Company with them. There were some bitter battles, nothing remarkable except somewhat later on, but there was one I recall when the company attacked this town on a hill called Saladuccio, and the Germans pulled out and we occupied it, and it was on a hill and they shelled it, something rotten, and we went into the crypt of the church with most of the adult population. All the Italians were there, men and women, shouting as the Italians do. And we were in there for some hours, and we were absolutely shelled, something rotten. And that was quite frightening. But nobody was killed. It was just the sort of, the noise effect was the worst of it. And we came out of there and moved on somewhere else.
What was the character of this period of fighting? Was it, as before, you're attacking German lines then retreating, or was the Gothic line holding firm at that time?
We did a good job of work, actually. It was quite well planned, good tactical battle. We rolled up the Germans sort of prior. They had a prior line of fortifications in front of the Gothic line, and we rolled it up fairly quickly, got into the Gothic line somewhat earlier, I guess, than they'd intended, had some very hard battles in the Gothic line, but eventually did break through. I think the real problem subsequently was that there wasn't just one line, you see, it was all mountainous, and the thing just went on and on and on, so you really didn't get through at all. But the next sort of memorable battle that we were in was a hill called Germano, which for a period and for a short time was probably quite the most vicious battle that I ever known, and was quite an outstanding battle, really, except to the degree that not many people know about it.
Tell us about it. What did you see of it?
Well, there were a number of minor peaks, and there were little villages around Germano. Villa was one. There were about four or five battalions in the area trying to drive the Germans off this peak. The main battle was performed by another brigade or two. We had a subsidiary part about it, but we were conscious of the fact that it really was quite a vicious battle. And in anticipation, one of the remarkable things about it is that after the battle had ended, they found one soldier from the Lincolnshire Regiment who was clutching a cross which was at the top on the summit of Germano, and that summit had fallen into German and English hands two or three times, and that fellow obviously had died there and stayed there during the course of the range of the battle. Now, our role at one point in this as a company was to protect the flank, I would guess, of the people who were attacking the main mountain area on the forward slopes. And we were told our role was just to act there as a warning in case of attacks and to repel any attacks that there were. But it was a gully, a very steep gully indeed, on the far side of this hill. And we were there as a company, spread along this gully, no more than about a couple of yards wide, very steep shoulders on it. And it was beautifully designed for mortar fire. And the Germans had it marked out as a mortar target. And they dropped mortars in there, and it was hell. We got in there in the beginning, took the radio set in, and we're on radio. Remember the first night, a detachment arrived from signals headquarters, two or three of these lads from base, in fear and trembling, come over the lip of the hill and said, "We brought you a cable here and a telephone handset." I said, "You can get bloody stuff for that. I don't want it." They said, "You've got to take it." So they brought us in this cable and handset, and we were in touch on the telephone wire at that moment in time, and we shut down the set temporarily. Of course, during the course of the night, the line went dis, as I knew it would do, because the shelling around there was absolutely horrible. So there was only Jackie Wells and I were there. This was at a point in time where they were short of personnel, and we were down to just two men terminals. And this was a very dodgy sort of life for the signaller, because what was happening was they were using two men terminals, and then they would push another two men up even further forward with platoons using heavy 38s or whatever they were. So I mean, you were getting really dicey situations then, which we thought was quite unfair to the signals trade union, that we were getting into really even deeper waters. Anyway, the line went dis. So I looked at Jackie Wells and said, "All right, I'll go back and look at the bloody thing." So I wanders back with this line in my hand. And at the top of the hill, I mean, naturally, there was a break in it. So then I looked around for the other part of the line, and of course, it had been blown by a shell or whatever and was yards and yards away, and I found it. I got that one in that hand, got the other one. And this was in the pitch dark, and the two lines were about a yard apart. And I said, "Well, shit it, I bugger off, I'm going to do anything about this." So I threw the cable away, went back down into the gully and told the commanding officer, who was Giffutter, I think, at the time, and said to him, "Your bloody cable's out of order, and I'm not putting it back on again. We'll have to go back onto radio." So I went back on the radio again, and they weren't at all charmed in HQ. I said, well, if you want to repair it, you can bloody repair it. I said to them, my pal, we had what was known as the commanding officer's set, which was usually a terminal run by a couple of lads who were mates of mine, Les Brown and Danny Jordan. And that set went with the commanding officer, who moved around a bit. So there was also a battalion headquarters set.